Are you feeling overwhelmed by hormonal changes? If you're a woman, you're not alone. With over 1,000 hormone disruptors in our environment, it's no wonder things can feel out of balance. On top of that, natural changes like PMS, menopause, and other life stages can leave you feeling tired, irritable, and trapped in a constant battle with your body. But here's the good news. You don't have to suffer through it. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is here to help. This herbal formula fine-tunes your hormones, balancing estrogen, testosterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol, which can contribute to weight gain, racing thoughts, poor sleep, and more. With over 40,000 five-star reviews and a bottle selling every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. Ready to feel like yourself again? For a limited time, get 15% off your first order at happymammoth.com using code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
I know that from the language that the Archdiocese says they're trying to be more transparent. What kind of things have they done to ensure that they are being transparent?
Yeah, so we've asked the review board to issue an annual report, which up until now they've operated, they've done their job. They've been very good, but by and large, their work has remained unknown to the public. The public trusts that they're doing their job and they'll hear from the review board if they need to. The Archbishop has asked the review board to issue a report every year. And so they'll actually do that and issued their first one just in the last few weeks for the previous year. The Archbishop asks that all new allegations of abuse are dealt with in a transparent way. So if the allegation is against somebody who is in active ministry, we will hold a public meeting in the parish for that individual served, whether it's a volunteer, a teacher, a coach, a priest, whoever. And we've done that on many occasions. We use the diocesan communications channels to communicate. We work with the local media to communicate anything that we have, any knowledge that we have of abuse allegations. So I think those are all really important and necessary. And then there's another piece, which is the transparency involved in our outreach to victim survivors. And so we will communicate regularly about settlements, about how money is expended, about the source of money that's used to settle abuse cases or counseling assistance that we provide to victim survivors. All of that, I think, is part of a large puzzle that demonstrates the church's efforts to be transparent and to try and make sure that the people of the diocese know what is happening with respect to abuse in the church and the church's efforts to rid the church of abuse.
I know that when I reached out to you, I mentioned that I've been working on this podcast on Sister Kathy's case. And of course, I've been able to speak with most of the survivors during that time. I went through the names on the list, and I don't know if you're aware of this, so I also wanted to make sure that you were. One of the names on the list for the review board is Sister McCarran. McCarran lives with accused nuns who are accused of destroying records at Keo after Sister Kathy's murder, we believe protected Sister Eileen Wiseman, who did not report abuse.
Wait, we or who? Are you talking about yourself or are you talking?
Yes, as a podcaster. Yes.
Okay.
We and believe.
On what information do you say that we believe? You've heard half the story, but you believe.
Correct. So the information that we received was, and again, this is just me wanting to let you know of this in case you weren't aware, because I don't know where to report this information.
Yeah, it's inaccurate first.
information came from survivors that I spoke to. That's why I wanted.
That's why I think it's important to have accurate information before you make a determination. I understand where they're coming from. Their issue with Sister McCarran being on the review board stems from the fact that Sister Eileen Wiseman, who, as you mentioned, was accused of not handling allegations of abuse dating back. This involved a lay teacher, John Mertzbacher, decades ago in South Baltimore, where she was a principal or a teacher. I don't recall which. She is a member of the same order as Sister McCarran, who runs a school that is sponsored by the School Sisters of Notre Dame. On the campus of that school is also a convent in which Sister Eileen had been residing in retirement. Sister McCarran has no say over who lives in that convent. It is run by her order. Her order determines who lives there and who does not live there. Sister Eileen no longer lives there. It's my understanding that the order has moved her. None of that is relevant to Sister McCarran's ability to serve on the review board. Her track record in operating her school for over a decade is beyond reproach. She brings a much valued and needed perspective of that of someone who runs a large and successful school, because the reality is very few of the cases that we're dealing with that are present day cases deal with clergy. The vast majority are issues related to school issues, teacher interactions with students, coach interactions with students. So as the review board is hearing facts of those kinds of cases, having the perspective of the head of a school, especially a large school, and somebody who's been doing it for a long time, not only as an administrator, but before that as a teacher, but also as a member of religious order, because many of the issues we deal with pertain to religious orders. It just fills a very important and valid role, and she does her job extremely well, and her role on the board is very much appreciated. And so I think to try and suggest because someone from her order lived on the same property where her school is, I think is misguided.
From my standpoint, and again, I'm just the public, but it does look like she could be compromised. Do you see what I was trying to relay?
I do. I just think it's a bridge too far. I think if there's an assumption there that she somehow was a facilitator or a protector or that, in other words, because she lived on the same property or because she was a member of the same religious community, that she somehow could not be objective or that somehow she had an opinion about what happened decades ago. It ignores the reality of the situation, which is she brings a much valued perspective and one that we feel is sufficiently independent and not at all impacted by those circumstances.
I mentioned earlier that there's a lot about the way the Catholic school system works and the church works that I don't know. And it's hard for me to find that information online as well. There's not just a Google Catholic search that I can search things up. But when I was looking at that case specifically, when the student reported the abuse of Mertzbacher, I noticed that the student ended up in a mental hospital because of an evaluation done by Joseph Maskell. But what I don't know from a non-Catholic standpoint is if Maskell wasn't on the staff, what was in place to allow him to evaluate that student?
Yeah, I don't know the circumstances of that particular case, but I can tell you that a priest who isn't on the faculty could serve as a chaplain. They have various less formal responsibilities. They may not be. In other words, they may not appear in a directory, but it doesn't mean they weren't there or they didn't serve in some capacity. In 2019, it's very uncommon for a priest to have any kind of a formal role where it pertains to a school. There just aren't as many priests, and religious aren't in the schools the way they were back decades ago. The schools were almost solely administered and taught by religious. Often it was nuns and brothers who were in the schools, and so it would be more common then for them to be on campus, even if they weren't there, and even if they weren't on the faculty per se. They may still, especially when you had religious orders, if there was a priest or a nun or a brother from the same order that was available to help out, they would almost see them as interchangeable. And even though the schools may have been owned by the diocese, say Archbishop Keogh was, because the religious community ran them, there was no reason for us to be involved in the day-to-day, and we wouldn't be. We would have no knowledge whatsoever about the day-to-day operations of the school. It was entrusted to the religious communities that administered them, and we would count on them to keep us abreast of anything that we needed to know about, or if there were problems or things that needed to be known, then that's the only way we would know about them.
Earlier, we were talking about priests that get removed or get their faculties taken away, but specifically for the ones that, prior to that standpoint of their faculties being removed, I know that there are treatment facilities that some accused priests go to. Can you tell me what those facilities are used for?
Yeah, so I think it's important to talk about that in a historic perspective. Certainly prior to the charter in 2002, but even here in Baltimore, it was probably prior to the 1990s, it would not be uncommon for someone accused to be sent to a facility for evaluation and treatment. And the bishop would do that to try and understand, you know, what the priest's capacity was for continuing ministry. If the evaluation came back that it was a treatable situation where the person would be there for an extended evaluation and they would undergo a battery of tests, meetings with professionals, and then they would determine, is it treatable, is it not? And they would come back and they would tell the bishop that he is either a risk to reoffend and thus should not be returned to ministry, or he would say that the man was sufficient to return to ministry, was no longer a threat to harm anyone else. And the bishops would rely on that. And that was not inconsistent with how the medical community at the time viewed these types of crimes. They didn't see them as crimes per se. They saw them as behavior to be managed. They didn't understand them the way they do today. They didn't understand that the recidivism was much too high and much too risky to return them to society as they had been. And that was the practice up until certainly the 90s, if not a little bit earlier. Today, priests go for evaluation for a number of different things, but unrelated to this. Now, if a priest is deemed to have abused, there's no reliance on any kind of an evaluation or anything like that, because it's a zero tolerance policy. Now there's no effort made to rehabilitate or to treat someone of what we now know to be untreatable. And so the focus there is on removing the individual so he can't harm again. And more of the focus is on the treatment of the person who has been harmed and not on the person who's done the harm. But we still rely on facilities like St. Luke's and others around the country that specialize the care, the psychological care, the psychiatric care of priests who face a wide range of challenges like any profession. And it's just that they specialize in priests, and so they understand their unique challenges. And men who are priests leave the ministry because they realize that they can't live that life anymore, or it takes its psychological toll on them, because it's, you think you're up to the challenge and you think you can do the job, again, not unlike any other walk of life, and then you realize you can't. I think the difference for priests is that your work is your life. It's your home. It's your social circle. It's where you go to work, but it's also you're married to the church. You're the bride is the church. And you try and do the best you can to prepare men for that life. You try to do the best you can to recruit and attract men you think are able to live that life and do so in a healthy way. But there are times when men need care and come back completely fine and able to continue in their job, and other times they're not. And you transition them into another way to live outside of the priesthood. And so that's really how these centers operate today. And again, St. Luke's is one of the best known ones. They're in Silver Spring, Maryland. And I think, you know, that because of the way they were used in the past, they probably is some stigma in the public's eye, but really they serve a very valuable and healthy part of church life today.
So the treatment centers, were they a part of the church?
No, they're independently run. They're run by other nonprofits, but they're not, the church does not sponsor them or operate them anyway.
So back when they were used to try to get the pedophilia to go away kind of thing, how many were in the U.S. of these treatment facilities that would be used?
That I don't know. The only thing I can tell you is that they did exist. Again, I know there is a kind of a stigma. I can't say it never happened, but I've seen the reports. I've seen enough in the files. When you review these files every year, you see them and they take a very honest look about, it's very clear why the bishop sent them there. They're aware that the individual they're evaluating was accused of abuse. And their job is to determine what to recommend to the bishop. And I think bishops obviously wanted these men to be returned to ministry, but there were many cases where they weren't, because they were, the clinical evaluation said that they weren't healthy. They were a risk. We don't talk about them or hear about those cases, but there were many. And there were cases where the evaluation was wrong. And again, the internet is littered with articles about how the medical community and the psychological community's knowledge about these types of abuses has evolved drastically over the years, that we just know way more today than we did then. And it's easy today. We look at it, it's very black and white. You can call it a disease or an illness or whatever, but it's a crime first, and it should be treated as a crime. And that's not how it was treated back then.
When the church would use the facilities back then, it sounds like they would send them there, then they would receive an evaluation. Was that evaluation public information, or was it just solely for the use of?
No, it would be just the same kind of thing that HIPAA would protect today. It would be a part of your personnel file, but it would be, that's where it would live. It would just be used to make a determination about their fitness for ministry.
Does HIPAA currently still protect those files from back then?
It's very much a medical file. It's an evaluation. If you were in your job, if you were having emotional problems and your boss offered to send you somewhere for an evaluation, you could certainly appreciate why that file should not be in the public. Even if you went on to do bad things, it's a part of your personnel file. And the reason why it existed was to help guide decision-making about their future employment or ministry.
With how many survivors that have come forward and have gone through mediation, do you know the number of how many there have been in the last 5 years or so?
I don't. I can certainly get a number for you. I just don't know it off the top of my head.
From talking with some of the survivors that I've been able to speak with, I was curious on how the mediation meetings work. Can you walk me through that process?
I can walk you through it as best I know it. For confidentiality purposes, I haven't been in them. And had I sat through them, I probably would still be circumspect, just out of respect for the survivors, not to divulge too much. But as sure. I understand it, there's a retired non-Catholic judge who serves as a mediator. And we require each victim survivor to have an attorney that we pay for. And the reason why, even though there have been times when they've said, I don't need one, or I'll use you all, we want them to feel like their interests are being represented, and we don't want anyone to feel like after the fact that their interests weren't. So it's important that they have representation. And so we have them there, and we have a lawyer there, as well as the Child and Youth Protection Office director, who serves as the point person for us on handling, certainly as a contact person for victims. Her primary role is to be a liaison between the church and victim survivors, but she's also a very important part of our investigative process when it comes to investigating allegations that come in. And so typically it'll be 4 or 5 people in a room, and they'll discuss the facts of the case, and then the judge will be the person who makes the determination in terms of putting a number on what that agreement should look like. But I think it's important to know that while we do offer that mediated settlement as a outreach gesture, it's not required. When we meet with victims of abuse, the first thing we say is, we want you to get counseling, and we want you to get it from someone you're comfortable with and that you want. So you choose who you want to go to, and we'll pay for that as long as it's necessary and helpful. And we pay the provider directly. We try to make it as easy and not burden the, in other words, we don't require the victim survivor to track down the billing and to track down the checks or get reimbursed or anything like that. We do it for them. We do it for their spouses or their direct family members, because we understand abuse takes its toll on more than just the individual who was abused. But for people who have been in that kind of situation for a long time where we've been doing that, some of them do get to a point where they really want to be in control of their own healing and therapy, and they will want to participate in that mediation program. And we ask that a certain part of that final number be set aside for future counseling. And then it's up to them to whether or not they want to avail themselves of it. But it's really a pastoral gesture, recognizing that for some victims, they just want to be in control of their own healing and not to have the church directly involved anymore.
With the mediation meetings, do you guys, when survivors reach a settlement, do you guys pay the money towards the therapy expenses, or do they just get the check and they get that money?
It's in lieu of. In other words, we say to them, we'll continue to pay for your therapy for as long as you need it. But if you want to do this mediation instead, then that becomes a lump sum. So it's not a both and situation. It's really either or. If the idea is that the church should compensate victims for healing, then we agree with that. And that's why we do this. We're not required to do it. There's no threat of litigation. We do it because it's the right thing to do. And recognizing that there's nothing we can do to fully restore what was taken from them. There are some victim survivors who just say, I'm fine with just keeping the arrangement the way it is. And just, I know I'm going to need therapy for the foreseeable future rather than risk that running out or exceeding what I might get in a settlement. I would just rather the church pay my counseling. We do that. Again, it's only that we enter into these mediated settlements with survivors when they want it. And we make it very clear to them and their attorney that in agreeing to that, that means that kind of ongoing counseling payment stops. And we make it very clear that's still an option if they would prefer that.
Did you say earlier that you provide them the money to pay for an attorney?
Yeah, we require that they have an attorney for the mediation, and that is paid by the diocese, to my knowledge.
Okay. So it's not taken out of the settlement. It's just paid.
Yeah, no, there's a representation there, yeah.
Gotcha, okay.
If they roll that in or how that's worked out. But it's not like we say, hey, you got to go get an attorney and it's up to you to pay for it.
I got you. The final question I had, earlier I was able to interview the filmmakers of The Keepers. And one of the things that they shared was how quickly the Archdiocese came out calling the docuseries fictional. Do you guys still keep that thought, or has your opinion changed at all?
Are you feeling overwhelmed by hormonal changes? If you're a woman, you're not alone. With over 1,000 hormone disruptors in our environment, it's no wonder things can feel out of balance. On top of that, natural changes like PMS, menopause, and other life stages can leave you feeling tired, irritable, and trapped in a constant battle with your body. But here's the good news. You don't have to suffer through it. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is here to help. This herbal formula fine-tunes your hormones, balancing estrogen, testosterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol, which can contribute to weight gain, racing thoughts, poor sleep, and more. With over 40,000 five-star reviews and a bottle selling every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. Ready to feel like yourself again? For a limited time, get 15% off your first order at happymammoth.com using code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
No, and that was something that was thrown around loosely by people who, including the director, who chose to turn it into something it wasn't. In other words, there were parts of the documentary that were grossly distorted, if not outright inaccurate. And I know that the tweet that they're talking about where it referred to that, and it wasn't written, I would certainly, if I were to do that, it wasn't my tweet, but if I were to do that, I certainly would have made that more one connected to the Archdiocese suggesting that the stories of the survivors was inaccurate or that they were no one's questioning the extent of their abuse. No one is questioning that Joseph Maskell was a monster and evil and should have been put in jail and buried under the jail. We all acknowledge that. The reality is that the docuseries told some of the story accurately and some of the story inaccurately. And that tweet was a reference to the inaccurate parts.
What parts were inaccurate?
Many suggestion that the diocese knew before Gene Wiener came forward in the 90s that Joseph Maskell had been accused of abuse was just patently wrong. And they held that out as some form of smoking gun at the end and completely exploited Jean's emotions. And you saw how she reacted. And they tried to suggest that, you know, all of the abuse that happened at Keough could have been avoided had the diocese just acted on what it knew in the 60s. When the reality is the diocese did not know in the 60s. Until Gene Wiener comes forward in the 90s, there's not a single record or shred of evidence to prove that the diocese knew anything. And it's why the church pressed so hard in the 90s when that first allegation came forward to corroborate it. Had we had knowledge in the 60s, if there was something in the file from the 60s that Joseph Maskell had been accused, when Gene comes forward in the 90s, it's simple, slam dunk. This is a second allegation. We got to get this guy out of ministry. That was a really important and damaging claim that the series made in an attempt to add great dramatic effect and to put some kind of finality to it. There was all kinds of suggestions, the way it portrays the church when Gene does come forward, as though the church didn't care or the church just said, Gene, you find somebody else and we don't want to know if anybody else has been abused or had been abused by Maskell. That couldn't have been further from the truth. There was great effort made to try and substantiate and corroborate what had been a changing story. Every conversation about this allegation seemed to change. And so this was a guy who had never had an allegation against him. 20 plus years after the fact, someone comes forward and says, I know there are others out there who were abused. I'm just not going to speak for them, which is understandable, but the church has to find someone else to corroborate it in its attempt to determine credibility. And the way the series portrayed it made it seem like the church really didn't want to believe it, didn't make an effort to corroborate it, and treated Gene very coldly. And then just the idea that we said from the very beginning, the first probably 2 years before the series ever came out, when they first contacted us, we said from day one, as I'm doing with you today, you have any questions whatsoever, we'll answer every single one of them. But we're not going to do it on camera. And we were very clear about that. And that was precisely because of the way you saw some of the interviews, how they were portrayed and manipulated, where they're going to ask about the minutia of cases or allegations that were decades old and expect someone like me or someone else to be able to pull all of these details out on camera without looking incompetent at best. And as though they're hiding something at worst, simply because not all of these details are just going to be on the tip of your tongue. They all required going back and looking at files that of events that happened when I was 2 years old. At the end of the day, in spite of our many offers to answer questions, they right before the series aired, they sent us a list of 6 questions total. None of the questions pertained to the most damning claims or the most important details. They were fairly superfluous, if I remember them. But so it was a very disingenuous effort on their part to understand the facts of a case that we've been talking about since the 90s, when the allegations first surfaced in 92 or 93. From that point on, we had been talking about them for years. Every 2 years, somebody would want to do an expose. Baltimore Magazine did a huge one in 94 or 95. The Baltimore Sun had done numerous, very detailed articles. And the church always complied and always participated and shared what we knew. So I don't blame the people who put the series together for having interest in it, because obviously it's a very compelling story. I just blame them for not trying harder to be accurate in the way they portrayed it. And it should have just been presented as, here are the facts, and people can make their own judgments. Instead, it was a very pointed and slanted presentation of opinions and stories, many of which were true. And again, you can't help but have your heart ripped out listening to the claims and the stories and the accounts of the people who were abused. And the one great regret is that there wasn't an opportunity for us to win the peace, publicly apologize again for the fact that we had somebody representing the church who was responsible for that damage. And even if we didn't know about it ahead of time or didn't see warning signs or didn't, the reality is it was somebody who we put in that position. And for all of the things that that were wrong in the way that was presented, nothing can change that fact. And so that's something that the church has to live with. And I think that's one of the underlying foundational principles for why we do feel an obligation to these people and their families. Because if it weren't for this person that we ordained and that we assigned, their lives would be vastly different. And we're responsible for that. And I think not having an opportunity to say that and to share that, and for that to be represented as part of kind of the record, if you will, I think is a regret. But we strive every day to prevent another one single incident of abuse, because when you hear those stories, you can't help but be motivated to prevent that from ever happening again.
I know that prior to Gene coming forward in the 90s, the filmmakers were using the words of survivor Charles Franz. Are you saying that his accusations about coming forward to the church then wasn't accurate? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I don't want to get into character. I don't want to deal with individuals directly, but the reality is that on at least two occasions, he acknowledges that his mother never knew of Maskell's abuse towards him. He's not named, but referred to in the mid-90s expose that Baltimore Magazine did. And then again, in a meeting here with his attorney, it wasn't a mediation itself, but in a meeting with diocesan officials, he again reiterated that his mother didn't know. So that to be a smoking gun without ever an opportunity to rebut that, I think, is just grossly inaccurate and grossly unfair. What his encounters were with Maskell, I think, I'm sure that it seems obvious that there were run-ins, and if he was abused, he deserves support and empathy, and the church is obligated to him as well. But that's different from someone knowing about that and reporting it. You know, no one's questioning whether or not he was abused. The crux of the issue is whether or not he told his mother and his mother reported it.
One of the other claims that Charles had was that Father, I think it's Maluli.
Yes.
Visited him in the 90s during the Doe Roe case for counseling and support. Is that also not accurate?
No, I don't think anyone's rebutting that he would have met with Bishop Maluli. I think he wasn't a bishop at the time, but the claim that he was offered a boat is what we said was completely false and inaccurate.
Do you know why Maluli would have visited him at all? Did he contact you guys? Was that the case?
I don't remember. Typically what would have happened was if someone claimed that he had been abused, there would have been a meeting with diocesan officials to hear the allegation. And then at some point, there would have been an offer of counseling assistance offered. Maluli, in his capacity at the time, would have been the person to meet with victims. And so Dr. Franz would have come in and said he had been abused. It would not have been uncommon for him to meet with him. But there is no way on a stack of Bibles that I believe that he would have been offered a boat. I think more likely, knowing Bishop Maluli as I do, it's that he would have said, we want you to get healing. We want to help you get what you need. But if you're here because, you know, we're going to write you a big check or give you a boat, that's not going to happen. And I think as I understand it, that's what more than likely would have happened. But no more in a position to give somebody a boat or would have thought about giving somebody a boat. And it just, none of that makes any sense whatsoever.
So you guys possibly believe that Charles came forward after hearing about the Doe Roe case?
Yeah, like I said, no one's refuting that he was abused. I can't say he was or he wasn't. And I don't know the specific dates, but it would have been in that time frame. It would not have been. There was no knowledge and no report from the 60s that he'd been abused by Maskell. It wasn't until well after. Gene Wiener was the first allegation that the Archdiocese knew that Joseph Maskell had been abusing kids. And she came forward, I believe, in 92. That was the first allegation that the church received about Maskell abusing kids.
In with this question, but just out of kind of a personal curiosity, who do you think killed Sister Kathy?
That I do not know. And if I can certainly tell you that if the church had any knowledge of anything that could help solve it, that the police would long have had it in their possession. We continue to offer any information that they need, any support, help, cooperation. I can tell you that there's nothing, and I've seen a lot of paperwork on Joseph Maskell, and I can tell you that there's nothing that would implicate him in it. I can tell you that the police interviewed him, that they had a chance to sit down and talk to him, that he was available to them back in the 90s when this was all first being discovered and talked about. And I can tell you that one of the things that we appreciate about the series is that it keeps her memory alive. It's clear that she played an important role in the lives of children who were living a horror and a nightmare every day. And nothing would give us greater satisfaction than for there to be a resolution to that for the sake of her family and for those who continue to keep her name alive.
That's all the questions I had. Besides, can I have all the paperwork that you have of Maskell? Can I review that?
I can tell you that the Attorney General will be doing that for you. Yeah. So stay tuned.